So I was in Walmart the other day looking for charcoal and lighter fluid, and I know exactly where they keep that, at the Walmart on the South Loop. Went to find it and discovered, rather to my sudden surprise, that the barbecue season has apparently given way to the Christmas season. Because that's where the ornaments and trees are. So I had to ask where to find this stuff. And I'm going, wait a minute, it's not even close to Halloween yet, much less Thanksgiving. How can Christmas be bearing down on us? I understand why this is. Christmas is a time when we get this wonderful image of the Lord High God becoming one with us. This notion that God choosing to take on human form makes us very much alike. It takes that whole God created us in his own image part from Genesis and makes it real, and that's very appealing and very attractive. I understand that, but not yet. So the curmudgeon in me is going to talk today about maybe the most profound way that I can think of that God and God's world, or the person of God and the people he created, are very, very different. And for that, I want to borrow from the Epistle to the Hebrews, chapter 8. This is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says the Lord. I will put my laws into their minds and write them on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they will be my people. For I will be merciful toward their iniquities, and I will remember their sin no more. The writer to the Epistle to the Hebrews didn't make those words up. He's actually quoting verbatim from the prophecy of Jeremiah chapter 31. Suggest to me that this idea, I will forgive their iniquity and remember their sin no more, which we find in the Old Testament prophecy of Jeremiah referring to the fallen people of Israel, now quoted in the New Testament in light of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection, this might be vaguely important. I will remember their sin no more. That's what distinguishes the Lord High God from God's people. Because memory is very important to us. And in fact, how hard it is to forgive and forget illustrates just how far away we are from the mind and providence of God. Memories and remembering things are actually vital to our life together. Those who forget history are destined to repeat it. Since last we met, Jeannie and I had a chance to spend a lot of time remembering very profound American history in the place where it occurred. We spent a couple of days in Philadelphia, went to Independence Hall, saw the inkwell into which the signers of the Declaration dipped their pens, signed the Declaration of Independence, and at the same time, in effect, were signing their own death warrants for the crime of treason. Strikes me Congress might pay a little more attention to what they're doing if the stakes were anywhere close to that high even today. But the inkwell was stunning, among other things. Nose to nose with the Liberty Bell, the bell that hung in the tower of Independence Hall and rang on July 8th, 1776, to summon the people to the assembly where the Declaration was read. We ate dinner at City Tavern, a building that has served food and drink to people since 1773, including Ben Franklin, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, who ate and drank in that place and cooked up the Revolution. Amazing and stunning and awe-inspiring. A few days later, we toured the Gettysburg battlefield with a private guide who absolutely knew what he was doing and showed us the profound ways that history is remembered, but also how history would have been much different, but for just a few things, timed even minutes differently at the Battle of Gettysburg. And we were left profoundly moved by our enhanced memory of these events. Which suggests to me how difficult it must be and how far beyond our ability to understand this notion of not remembering, of not just setting it aside, but literally not remembering their sin, that God has said in both the Old and New Testament is what he does. I will remember their sin no more. There's a sort of fractured Italian word, I think, that captures this sentiment. It's not even a real word. It's in the Urban Dictionary. The word is squadouche. The Urban Dictionary definition is absent, gone, forgotten, not there. To use it in a sentence, you might say, Uncle Tony was going to bring cannolis and sausage. What does he bring? Squadouche. It evokes an imaginary and yet not uncommon stereotypical scene where one life, where maybe our life, passes from life to life eternal. St. Peter opens the book. We've got the list of sins. St. Peter's kind of gloating because he can read the list. What are you going to do with this next guy, God? To which, if we are to understand what God might do next in light of this passage, squadouche! I forgot! It's not there! Amazing, isn't it? It highlights the distinction between God's job and our job. God's job is to deal with the creation of and the population of the heavenly realm. Our job is here on earth for the 80, 90 years that we're given to do this. Illustrating God's job is not easy from a human point of view. One of the classic pieces of work in our discipline of sociology is a book entitled The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, written by Max Weber. And in it he argues that this, what we understand as a Protestant ethic, diligence, moderation, frugality, clean living, and so on, is actually the result of an understanding of Calvin's doctrine of predestination, which on the face of it's kind of scary. John Calvin, who's the father of Presbyterianism, put forward in a more complicated way than I want to try to talk about today, this notion that with respect to who gets into heaven and who doesn't, this decision has already been made. God has predetermined before any of us were born, before even the earth was created, who gets into heaven and who doesn't. Again, a rather frightening idea, because no one can know, no one can control it, according to this idea. Well, Weber argued that the development of the Protestant ethic was an effort by people who were sort of anxious about this to be able to say to themselves, and even perhaps others, I must be one of God's elect because I'm working hard, doing right, accumulating with integrity a reasonable legacy. He stuck in his thumb and pulled out a plum and said, what a good boy I must be. If the plum is there, you've got to work on the plum. I've written an article that's being reconsidered for publication by a journal now that is kind of a tongue-in-cheek takeoff on this. It's entitled The Protestant Ethic and the Religious Tattoo, suggesting that those who choose to adorn themselves permanently, from a human point of view, with a religious symbol must in effect be saying to God, this must mean I'm one of your chosen, and sort of mitigating the anxiety of this predestined population for heaven. In a strange sort of way, even the doctrine of predestination frees us from having to worry about God's responsibility, and it leaves us free to take care of the business God has asked us to take care of. God has simply said to us, you have a place, you have a time, you have a world, do some good. Do some good. And to outline what our job is as distinct from what God's is, I want to call to mind what I've told my students from time to time is my favorite Bible verse, which, by the way, isn't even in the Bible, but should be. 2 Corinthians 3:16, let not the ideal be the enemy of the good. Good can be done even though we live in an imperfect and fallen world, even though our abilities are imperfect and our motivations are often mixed. There is good to be done. Ideally, we didn't hypothetically need a revolution to live freely apart from a tyrannical colonial regime. In real life, it took a war. It took a great deal of bravery and a great deal of good done by the people who've left us this country since July 4th, 1776. Ideally, we shouldn't have had to settle the question of slavery in armed conflict. But there are stories of great heroism and bravery, and even negotiation and the changing of one's mind that leave us a legacy of good. Robert E. Lee, many years after the war, is quoted as having said, "When I began my role as General of the Confederacy, I was a Virginian. Today I'm an American." A great deal of good came from that, that I think has even moved us forward to and beyond the Jim Crow legacy of the South. Let not the ideal be the enemy of the good. Ideally, everyone in post-Texas should have 3 square meals a day. Short of that, it is good that this week is Food Pantry Day. Let not the ideal be the enemy of the good, and in whatever ways you are both empowered and limited, be about the business, your business, not God's, of doing good. The heavenly part will take care of itself. That's not your job. The earthly part, the day-to-day doing of good, is your job. And oddly enough, they're connected because one gives energy to the other. At the end of the day, I think we should be at least skeptical of any religious pronouncement, any set of doctrine, any sermon, any book, any television show that claims with any level of certainty to be able to say, this is how you get to heaven, this is who gets in, and I'm pretty certain that that one over there isn't going in. Skepticism, because that is simply not our job. But it raises, in some ways, an even more frightening question. Does anybody get in? Does everybody get in? That question was posed to my theology professor in seminary many years ago, almost as an afterthought to a class on the doctrine of salvation. Somebody said, "Well, what's being implied here? Is it universal? Does everybody wind up getting saved?" The professor said what any good professor would say when confronted with a direct question: give a direct answer. And the answer was, "I don't know. I don't know for sure." But then he said this, and this is almost word for word, and I've never forgotten it. He said, "What we do know is that God will judge the world, and God will judge each individual in it, in light of the degree to which he was willing to go, with grace and mercy, to have his son killed, to have his son absorb the punishment for all sin, and to defeat death with the resurrection. That is the criterion by which God will judge the world." And so it opens up again, not more than the possibility, even the likelihood, and in some sense maybe the inevitability, that at the moment you and I wind up moving from life to life eternal, and hypothetically the book is open, it opens up the possibility, the likelihood, the inevitability that the answer, the final word on our own life, will be squadoosh. If we lived as though we thought that might be true, we could really do some good. So let's go. Let's do some good. Squadoosh. Amen.